content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the September 22nd, 2017 issue of The Week magazine. The drawing on the front this week shows a mournful-looking Uncle Sam. He's standing about thigh-deep in water. In his right hand, he's got a mop. In his left hand, he's got a bag of money. He's got a tool belt with tools in it wrapped around his waist. And in the background, you see a car and a bent-over palm tree and a house trashed. And the title says, A State of Shock. Rebuilding Florida After Irma's Historic Devastation. And that will be the main story that we'll take a look at. Florida pummeled by Hurricane Irma. What happened? Millions of Florida residents began returning to their storm-battered homes this week after Hurricane Irma tore through the state, causing extensive flooding, widespread power outages, and billions of dollars worth of property damage. The record-breaking storm, which also pummeled the Caribbean, prompted some 7 million people to evacuate the Sunshine State. After making landfall in the Florida Keys as a Category 4 hurricane, Irma barreled northward up the peninsula's western side, covering the whole width of the state. While Miami was spared a direct hit from the eye, the 420-mile-wide storm still caused widespread damage elsewhere. The Keys were devastated, with a quarter of homes destroyed and another 65% damaged. Overall, up to 13 million people, two-thirds of Florida's population, lost power. Utility companies warned it would be weeks before electricity was fully restored. Irma weakened to a post-tropical depression after moving north out of Florida, but it continued to unleash high winds and heavy rainfall. A million people lost power in Georgia and the Carolinas. By Wednesday, the death toll across the whole region stood at 30, including 8 residents of Hollywood, Florida, nursing home who were left without air conditioning in extreme heat. We've got a lot of work to do, but everybody's going to come together, said Florida Governor Rick Scott. We're going to get this state rebuilt. What the editorial said, We've come a long way since Hurricane Andrew in 1992, said the Miami Herald. Back then, many Florida residents failed to take the warning seriously. This time, residents sensibly stocked up, boarded up, or pulled up stakes and hit the road. Irma could have easily been worse, said the Tampa Bay Times. Had the storm's eye directly hit our city instead of veering away, the storm surge would have been catastrophic. Half the population lives less than 10 feet above sea level. Now the priority is to restore power. In hot, humid Florida, air conditioning is a public health issue. Irma will require a long recovery period, said the Washington Post. The economic toll in the form of disruptions to business, increased unemployment, crop losses, and property and infrastructure damage could put the bill as high as $100 billion. But hopefully the devastation wrought by Irma and by Hurricane Harvey, which hit Texas only 2 weeks earlier, will shake Governor Scott and other Republicans out of their stubborn denial that climate change poses a serious threat. While individual storms cannot be attributed to global warming, scientists say, higher temperatures will make destructive hurricanes more common and severe. What the columnist said, There has never been a storm quite like Irma, said Robinson Meyer in theatlantic.com. It retained hurricane strength for 11 days, spent a record 3 days as a Category 5 storm, and whipped up 185-mile-per-hour winds for 37 straight hours, longer than any cyclone in recorded history. In addition, Irma formed in the Atlantic, a part of the world that usually does not produce huge hurricanes. To limit the impact of future storms, the government should stop tempting people into hurricanes' paths, said Nicole Galinas in the New York Post. The National Flood Insurance Program has provided heavily subsidized coverage that encouraged millions of people to build homes near coastlines. Some properties have had to rebuild several times, all on the taxpayers' dime. And with extreme weather on the rise, the program was already $24.7 billion in debt before Harvey and Irma. Why is the government spending billions of dollars keeping people in harm's way? Climate change is causing more extreme weather, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times. But under President Trump, every senior government official dealing with the environment is a know-nothing anti-science conservative. Environmental Protection Agency Chief Scott Pruitt insisted this week that even discussing global warming now would be insensitive. Really? We are being governed by people completely alienated from science and a rational assessment of what the evidence is telling us. This willful ignorance is deeply frightening and dangerous. Before we read the controversy of the week, I just noticed, and it wasn't all bad short, that I'd like to read for you. When Hurricane Irma made landfall in Florida, every coastal community needed help, including Florida's underwater inhabitants. At least two manatees were caught by surprise last week when the force of the Category 5 hurricane's winds sucked the water away from Tampa's shores, leaving the creatures stranded in the shallow marshes that remained, unable to move. The 500-pound sea cows proved difficult to lift, so passersby and local law enforcement banded together to roll them onto a tarp and drag them 100 yards to the surf. We said 1, 2, 3 and pulled them back to the channel, says citizen helper Marcelo Clavijo. They both swam off. Lucky sea cows. And now the controversy of the week. Trump's debt deal. The beginning of a centrist pivot. The pivot is real, said Ben Dominic in TheFederalist.com, and it's spectacular. When President Trump summoned congressional leaders to the Oval Office last week for talks on raising the debt ceiling, few expected much more than a photo op. Instead, Trump stunned Washington by striking a deal with Democratic leaders Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi that raised the debt ceiling for 3 months and provided an $8 billion aid package for victims of Hurricane Harvey. House Speaker Paul Ryan and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell were reportedly livid. They had wanted a clean bill raising the debt limit for 18 months so that Democrats couldn't use a possible government shutdown as leverage until after the midterm elections. But Trump wanted to make sure a shutdown fight wouldn't get in the way of his handing out hurricane aid. And like Bill Clinton, he will benefit from triangulating between the two parties. Remember, Trump was a New York City Democrat for most of his life, said Peggy Noonan in WSJ.com. He blames Ryan and McConnell for failing to deliver him any big legislative wins and may look for more opportunities to work with Chuck and Nancy, as he now calls his new Democratic pals. Don't expect Trump to turn into a centrist independent, said Benjamin Hart in NYMag.com. Trump is not about to abandon the tens of millions of aggrieved white people who elected him or the far-right agenda they elected him to enact. His deal with the Democrats arose out of an impulsive quest for a few days of good press and revenge on Republican leaders, not from some brilliant long-term strategy. Besides, Democrats are in no mood to throw Trump any lifeline, said E.J. Dionne in the Washington Post. His anti-immigrant virulence and race baiting have made the president morally radioactive, and his plummeting poll numbers and the gathering storm of the Russia probe have Democrats salivating at the prospect of regaining control of the House in next year's midterms. Schumer and Pelosi will be willing to deal with Trump if he makes concessions on a few issues, such as lifting the threat of deportation from the Dreamers. But they won't help him save his floundering presidency by reinventing himself as a centrist. If Trump does make concessions to the Democrats to get something done, said Cheryl Chumley in the Washington Times, Republicans will have nobody to blame but themselves. Their infighting kept them from repealing Obamacare, and they've made it clear they won't fight to fund the president's promised border wall. And yet they call Trump treasonous for cutting a deal to keep the government operating. Please. The president's supporters don't care how he puts some wins on the board, and it seems only sensible that Trump might as well wheel and deal with the Democrats, because the GOP sure isn't working with him. Congressional Republicans tried to work with Trump, said Michael Gerson in the Washington Post, but he's provided absolutely no leadership on health care or any other legislative issue. That's because this president has no discernible political philosophy and navigates from one moment to the next by means of instincts, reflexes, and prejudices that are governed only by his own immediate self-interest. McConnell and Ryan reluctantly decided to support Trump on the gamble that his political inexperience would let them set the agenda. That was a huge miscalculation. He could care less what the GOP wants. If Republicans don't now establish an identity apart from Trump, they will become complicit in their own humiliation and irrelevance. It was a good week for monkey business. After plaintiffs in a long-running lawsuit over a selfie taken by a smiling Indonesian macaque named Naruto reached a settlement, assuring that 25% of the future proceeds from the smiling monkey's famous picture will go to groups dedicated to protecting his species and his habitat. It was a good week for slinging suds after Oliver Strumpfell of Germany beat his own world record by carrying 29 full steins of beer using just two hands. The beer and glasses weighed 152 pounds. And it was a good week for real news after conservative radio host Rush Limbaugh told his listeners that dire forecasts of Hurricane Irma's impact were a liberal media plot to create fear and panic and advance this climate change agenda. He had to cancel his Friday show and flee Florida. But it was a bad week for Senator Ted Cruz, who blamed an unnamed staffer for, quote, screwing up and hitting the like button on Cruz's official Twitter account for a pornographic video. It was not me, Cruz said. It was a bad week for loving your dog too much after an Arkansas government worker pleaded guilty to spending $200,000 of public money to buy her pug a dog tuxedo, sequined throw pillows, and pet insurance, among other items. And it was a bad week for London sewer workers, who began using high-powered jet hoses to break up a giant fatberg, a 250-yard-long, 130-ton mass of congealed cooking oil, used diapers, wet wipes, and other refuse that is blocking a major sewer pipe. It's a monster, said an official. And before we move on from this page, a short Democrats embrace single-payer health bill. At least 15 Democratic senators, most of them presidential hopefuls, lined up to support Senator Bernie Sanders this week as he introduced legislation that would expand Medicare into a universal health insurance program. Sanders has introduced single-payer health legislation three times before, but he has never had a co-sponsor. This time, a roster of influential senators put their names on the bill, including Senators Kamala Harris, Democrat from California, Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts, and Cory Booker of New Jersey. Democratic leaders declined to endorse the measure, saying they wanted to focus on protecting Obamacare. The bill has no chance of passing in the GOP-led Congress. Republican Senator John Barrasso, a Republican from Wyoming, said Sanders' bill has become a costly litmus test for the liberal left. Our topic on the briefing page today is the presidential pardon. Presidents have almost unlimited power to grant clemency for federal crimes, but they don't always use it wisely. Why was this power created? The Constitution's Article 2, Section 2, gives presidents the power to grant pardons for offenses against the United States, except in cases of impeachment. Pardons can free people convicted of crimes from jail terms, formally forgive them without expunging their criminal records, and restore certain rights, to vote or bear arms, for example. The founders saw presidential pardons as a last resort for people wronged by the courts. Otherwise, justice would wear a countenance too sanguinary and cruel, Alexander Hamilton wrote in the Federalist Papers. Still, the principled argument for the power, he said, was to restore tranquility in case of armed resurrection, which motivated George Washington in granting the first pardon, and Abraham Lincoln's decision to pardon Confederate soldiers and all but the highest Confederate officials. When President Trump tweeted he had complete power to pardon, he wasn't far off. Chief executives have almost unlimited latitude to put aside convictions, but only of federal crimes, and they haven't been shy about using it. For most of American history, says political scientist P.S. Ruckman Jr., presidents pardoned frequently, early, and often. How does the pardon process work? Typically, offenders make a formal request to the Justice Department's Office of the Pardon Attorney, which advises executive clemency. The DOJ imposes a five-year waiting period after the pardon seeker's conviction or release. The Pardon Office evaluates the request, then makes a recommendation. There are times, however, when presidents circumvent this process. Former Maricopa County, Arizona chef Joe Arpaio, a staunch Trump supporter, never submitted a pardon request. Indeed, he'd yet to be sentenced for a contempt conviction arising from allegedly brutal and discriminatory immigration enforcement practices. Yet the president preemptively pardoned him. While pardons often do remedy injustice, presidents have repeatedly used this power for their personal, political, and familial interests, says constitutional scholar Jonathan Turley. When has the pardon been abused? Abuse can be in the eye and politics of the beholder. Thomas Jefferson was widely criticized for pardoning allies convicted under the Alien and Sedition Acts. More than a century later, President Warren G. Harding was accused of selling pardons for contributions and gave one to a mob enforcer suspected in 60 murders. Franklin D. Roosevelt pardoned Conrad Mann, convicted of running an illegal lottery, mainly because he was a close associate of Kansas City's notorious Democratic boss, Tom Pendergast. In 1971, Richard M. Nixon granted clemency to Teamsters President Jimmy Hoffa, who was doing 15 years for jury tampering and fraud. In 1972, the powerful Hoffa threw the union's support to Nixon's reelection bid. Of course, it was the 37th president himself who benefited from the most hotly debated pardon in U.S. history. What happened? When Nixon resigned over the Watergate scandal in 1974, he still faced potential prosecution for obstruction of justice and other charges. But a month after taking office, President Gerald Ford addressed the nation and offered his predecessor a full, free, and absolute pardon for crimes he committed or may have committed. Ford said he'd hoped to spare an already traumatized nation a divisive prosecution of a former president. But many suspected that Nixon had made a deal with his vice president to resign in return for the pardon. Ford's pardon contributed to his 1976 election loss to Jimmy Carter. "The pardon exacerbated the public's distrust of government," said historian Rick Perlstein, "reinforcing American sense that the president was above the law. It was hardly the last pardon to invite that perception." What other pardons were controversial? George H.W. Bush caught heat for pardoning Reagan Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger, indicted for perjury in the Iran-Contra scandal, along with five other defendants. Bush was Reagan's vice president during the illegal sale of arms to Iran, admitted having been present during discussions of the scheme, and was likely to have testified during the trials. President Bill Clinton very liberally used his pardon authority to benefit allies, including his own half-brother, Roger Clinton, and fugitive financier Mark Rich. Rich was one of the least worthy recipients of a pardon in modern history, a fugitive from justice who was unrepentant for his tax evasion, racketeering fraud, and illegal oil deals with Iran. President Barack Obama granted just 212 pardons, one of the lowest rates of any president. He did, however, commute sentences for 1,715 inmates, primarily nonviolent drug offenders serving harsh mandatory minimums, as well as for ex-intelligence analyst Chelsea Manning, who'd served 7 of 35 years for passing secrets to WikiLeaks. How might Trump use the pardon? There is speculation he may blunt Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation by preemptively pardoning everyone in his inner circle. Constitutional scholars disagree about whether Trump has the power to pardon himself. But Jeffrey Crouch, author of The Presidential Pardon Power, says a Trump self-pardon could very well backfire. A 1915 Supreme Court decision deemed accepting a pardon an admission of guilt. The standard for impeachment, treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors, is not criminal, it's political, Crouch says. So an acknowledgement of guilt made via a self-pardon could actually become a starting point for impeachment. The first pardon. Presidential pardons began with whiskey, more precisely a hefty tax on spirits enacted in 1791 to pay down Revolutionary War debt. The levy, as much as 30%, was a burden to poor farmer distillers and sparked violent protests. While President Washington counseled forbearance, Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton urged a more vigorous response. The so-called Whiskey Rebellion climaxed on July 17, 1794, when 500 insurgents burned the home of tax supervisor John Neville outside Pittsburgh. Reluctantly, Washington himself led a militia force of 13,000 to the area and easily put down the revolt. Two rebels, John Mitchell and Philip Weigel, were convicted of treason and sentenced to death. But on July 10, 1795, Washington granted them the first presidential pardon, expressing his belief that the new American government ought to exercise every degree of moderation and tenderness which the national justice, dignity, and safety may permit. And we will read a few of the best columns of the week now. We'll take one from the U.S., this one titled, Pretending That Gays Don't Exist. The Nashville statement sounds like the death rattle of a religious movement stuck in the 19th century, says Sarah Jones. The statement recently issued by the Tennessee-based Council for Biblical Manhood and Womanhood declares unequivocally that adopting a homosexual or transgender self-conception is in itself a sin. The 187 prominent evangelical leaders who signed the statement say God intended all human beings to be either male or female, and sex to occur only within heterosexual marriage. It's no shock, of course, that evangelicals are opposed to homosexuality. But the biblical literalists who issued this statement see the rising acceptance of gay people and gay marriage as a threat to their patriarchal worldview, in which women and men have distinct roles. So the statement insists that same-sex orientation and transgender identity are mere psychological conditions and are inherently immoral. No, quote, faithful Christian, the statement says, may disagree with this view. Millions of Christians do adamantly disagree, including the 47% of evangelicals under age 53 who support marriage equality. The Nashville statement only reveals the religious right's deep insecurity over its waning influence over how America thinks. Here's one from the Philippines. Don't be afraid of the ghosts. In the seventh month of the Chinese year, and that means it is the seventh month of the Chinese year, and that means Filipinos are freaking out about ghosts, said Michael Tan. Ghost month phobia has migrated here from China, even among those who aren't ethnic Chinese. Superstition says that hungry, cranky ghosts from the underworld are let loose to roam the earth this lunar month. While the phantoms can be soothed to some extent with offerings of liquor, food, and cigarettes, they will still cause havoc. That means Filipinos won't plan anything important for this month, be it long-distance travel, a business launch, a wedding, or even a surgical procedure if they can possibly be postponed. This year, people are being ridiculously literal in their fear, blaming several recent gruesome murders of teenagers on the ghosts. In fact, the myth probably came to us through Buddhism and is meant as a parable about karma. Those who live lives of greed turn into ghosts with insatiable hunger. We're supposed to take a moral lesson from the ghost month, not get hysterical from an irrational fear of the dead. Here's an idea. We should use this time to consider how to rein in the insatiable greed of the living ghosts, the corrupt and the power-hungry who encourage vigilante killings. That might actually make us safer. And this from Mexico, promising all gain, no pain. Mexico's perennial populist is promising to turn the country into the Garden of Eden, said Leo Zuckerman. Andre Manuel Lopez Obrador, known as AMLO, or AMLO, has been running for president for more than 10 years, and he is heavily favored to unseat President Enrique Peña Nieto in next year's election. And why shouldn't he be popular? He's running on his most inspirational, if implausible, campaign theme yet. Free stuff for everyone. Mexico's problem, AMLO tells us, is corruption. And that's not a sin among the people, who are inherently good, but at the top spheres of economic political power, from whence it cascades down to local levels. His solution is simple. If the president is honest, the governors will be honest, and so on down to the last governmental link. And all that honesty will supposedly save untold sums of money as the waste and luxuries of government agencies are abolished. With this miracle wealth, AMLO will fund projects, and more projects. Everyone will have access to the internet and to high-speed trains. The poor will get housing and paved roads. Wages will rise and taxes will fall. College will be free. Just vote AMLO, and an earthly paradise will be built in 6 years without any effort or sacrifice. Will Mexicans be duped? Our in-depth article this week is titled, When the Post Office Was Cutting Edge. For nearly 200 years, mail service in the United States was a hotbed of new ideas and innovation, said author and researcher Kevin Kosar. Where did it all go wrong? In 1897, a year when mail was still largely delivered by horse and wagon, construction began on an innovative scheme beneath the streets of Philadelphia. Using an intricate network of compressors and metal pipes, the new system could shoot a capsule holding a few hundred letters across a city in several minutes, far faster than a postman could get it there. The investor in this new technology wasn't some kind of delivery startup, the FedEx or UPS of its day. It was the U.S. Post Office. Behind the experiment was Postmaster General John Wanamaker, who was inspired by Paris, London, and other European cities that were trying out pneumatic posts. It seemed a natural fit for America's growing metropolises, where mail was hauled by horse cart and carried on foot. Wanamaker had the sense not to try to concoct such a system in-house, since the agency had no such expertise. So he did something clever. He called for private proposals to build pneumatic tube systems. The Pneumatic Transit Company of New Jersey was the winning bidder, and a public-private partnership was born. It agreed to pay to build the system, then to charge the post office for its use. The first tube could shoot a capsule of mail nearly three-fifths of a mile through a 6.5-inch tube from the city's main post office to the East Chester Street Post Office. Soon, similar systems were installed in Boston, St. Louis, and Chicago. New York City's system, the largest, could move 6 million pieces per day at 30 miles per hour from the Bronx to Manhattan and Brooklyn. Collectively, the post office's pneumatic tube system ran more than 120 miles with 130 postal rocketeers feeding mail into it every 15 seconds. When Americans think about the most innovative agency in the government, they think about the Pentagon or NASA. But throughout much of its history, that title could just as easily have fallen to the post office, which was a hotbed of new, interesting, sometimes crazy ideas as it sought to accomplish a seemingly simple task. Deliver mail quickly and cheaply. The post office experimented with everything from stagecoaches to airplanes, even pondered sending mail cross-country on a missile. For decades, the agency integrated new technologies and adapted to changing environments, underpinning its ability to deliver billions of pieces of mail every year, from the beaches of Miami to the banks of Alaska, for just cents per letter. We think a lot about how innovation arises, but not enough about how it gets quashed. And the United States Postal Service is a great example of both. Today, what was once a locus of innovation has become a tired example of bureaucratic inertia and government mismanagement. But its descent into its current state was not foretold. A series of misguided rules and laws have clipped the post office's wings, turning one of the great inventors of the government into yet another clunky bureaucracy. In a sense, innovation was baked into the post office from the beginning. America's National Postal Service precedes the founding. It was born in July 1775, a year before the Declaration of Independence was ratified. During the American Revolution, the U.S. postal system's duty was to deliver communications between Congress and the military commanders fighting the British. And for the first postmaster general, Congress appointed an inveterate tinkerer, Benjamin Franklin. He rigged up a system of contractors to haul mail by horse and on foot. It worked. From the start, the Post Office Department, as it was called until 1970, had to be innovative. There was little money to fund the startup agency, and its task, delivering mail to anywhere in the country, was immense. In turn, Congress gave the agency a good amount of operational freedom. In 1785, Congress authorized the post office to hire private stagecoaches to deliver mail. It was a smart idea that leveraged private sector investments in transportation, but did not commit the agency itself to bearing the great cost of purchasing horses and hiring riders. Later, the post office would contract to have mail carried by steamboats, railroads, and private delivery companies. The agency also had the authority to erect post offices, but at first it licensed tavern owners to provide postal services to thirsty customers instead. That changed during the 19th century when the Postal Service expanded massively. In 1790, the nation had 75 post offices. By 1900, there were more than 76,000. Then came home delivery. Mail reached many city dwellers at home by the mid-1860s and expanded to farmhouses and remote houses in the 1880s. Henry Ford built his first car in 1901. 4 years later, the post office was experimenting with mail delivery by automobile. The first half of the 20th century was a dynamic time for the post office. It immensely improved delivery by adopting innovations from the private sector and abroad. Much like the pneumatic tubes, some of the schemes incorporated new technology we no longer even associate with mail. During World War II, the post office adopted V-mail, an idea pioneered in England. Families wishing to correspond with soldiers overseas would write the letter on a V-mail form, which was placed in a capsule and shipped to a facility where it was scanned to microfilm. The 100-foot rolls of film, which could hold 1,700 letters, were carried overseas and unsealed, and then the letters were individually printed and delivered to the GI recipients. Overshadowing all the invention, however, was the creeping sclerosis of the post office as an institution. As a monopoly, it was insulated from competitive pressures, allowing inefficiency to creep into its operations and management. Worse, political interest had sunk deep. With Congress setting postage rates too low and too frequently trying to dictate the location of post offices and mail sorting facilities. Booming business, however, enabled the postal system to avert a crisis for decades. In 1900, 7 billion pieces of mail were delivered. By 1960, the agency was moving 63 billion letters and parcels. The department often ran a profit, and it sowed those profits into new mail delivery technologies. Things began to change in the 1960s. Postal workers unionized, and President John F. Kennedy authorized them to bargain collectively in 1962. Despite growing mail volume, the post office ran perennial deficits, and its investment in the guts of the system, mail receipt and sortation, lagged. The system broke down in Chicago in 1966, and 10 million pieces of mail were backlogged for days. After a wildcat strike broke out in New York City in 1970, Congress established the Post Office Department and replaced it with the U.S. Postal Service, an independent agency. The Postal Reform Act removed some of the congressional involvement in its operations. In exchange, policymakers reduced the agency's dependency on the U.S. Treasury and demanded it become self-sufficient. This new-look postal system had been conceived by a Nixon-appointed core of brain trusters and businessmen with the aim of turning the agency into a public corporation with minimal political interference. Instead, the plan infused the new agency's DNA with some of the same clashing political interests that were hobbling the agency. Big mailers benefit from subsidies written into the law. Postal workers must be unionized and are entitled to bargain collectively. Folks in far-flung Alaska and Hawaii are entitled to the same postage rates and services as everyone else, no matter the cost. And Congress continues to insist that mail be delivered 6 days per week to appease certain big mailers, postal unions, and some rural residents. Innovation at the agency flagged. Upgrades in mail processing machinery were delayed over union objections that jobs would be lost. So, too, were attempts to contract out more postal work to private carriers or delivery companies. USPS operations became increasingly governmental as collaboration with private sector companies flagged. At the same time, technology was rapidly catching up to the Postal Service. The first threat was actually a miss. Although the electronic fax arrived in the early 1970s, it did not eat into the USPS's business. So when cellular phone technology arrived in the late 1980s, the internet erupted in the mid-1990s, USPS officials mostly shrugged. Annual revenues climbed, and the USPS's employee cohort rose to nearly 800,000 before the end of the 20th century. The USPS did upgrade some of its internal technology. Its letter sorting machines have sensors with optical character recognition. Yet relative to the world around them, these improvements are nothing compared with the Post Office Department's innovations of the 18th and 19th centuries. Some of the new sorting machines have not been reliable, and the agency's parcel logistics lag behind those of private sector companies like FedEx and UPS. It is as if the agency has given up on innovation and is utterly confident that mail volumes and revenues will grow forever, which has been a huge mistake. In 2008, the Great Recession's teeth hit the mail business. Most mail is sent by big mailers, many of whom slashed their postal budgets and accelerated transferring their communications to less costly online means. Mail volume is down 25% since 2008, and the agency has been hemorrhaged money. More of what USPS carries is advertising mail, which generates low profits. The mail volume crash laid bare the cost of the USPS's loss of innovation mojo. It is a labor-intensive, paper-toting company in a digital age, and the USPS leadership has belatedly awakened to the reality that mail is not a growing business. Private sector companies may soon eat even more of the USPS's lunch. Amazon is building a delivery network of its own with lockers instead of post office boxes and experimenting with drones. Uber has also nosed into the delivery business, and other companies are experimenting with autonomous delivery vehicles and robots. USPS so far appears unable to innovate its way out of the mess it is in. The agency has $15 billion in debt and has shown little imagination to fundamentally transform the way it does business. The agency has piloted a grocery delivery business despite the 2006 congressional prohibition on the agency entering new non-postal businesses. To date, the USPS has not released any financial results for this experiment, which seems doomed to fail. Why grocers would rather pay highly compensated letter carriers rather than less costly bicycle delivery people or Uber drivers is anything but obvious. Nothing may sum up the Postal Service's inability to innovate more than its failed partnership with Staples. A few years ago, the Postal Service agreed with Staples to expand consumer access to its shipping services. Upon entering select locations of the office supply chain store, shoppers would find a familiar-looking counter resembling a mini post office containing the most popular postal products and services, the agency crowed. It was one-stop shopping and shipping, and Staples postal customer counters would be open 7 days a week. The agency began piloting the Staples arrangement in November 2013 in Boston. More than 500 Staples stores nationwide had retail postal counters by the end of last year. At first blush, the USPS Staples partnership looked like a win-win arrangement, but the American Postal Workers Union did not see it that way. It decried the deal as an effort at union busting because Staples personnel would man the postal counters. Earlier this year, the National Labor Relations Board killed the USPS Staples deal. Too weary to fight or fearful that it could not win in court, the USPS capitulated, and the Staples postal counters are being dismantled. Pneumatic tubes didn't survive either. They became a victim both of their design and the post office's success. Mail volumes grew fantastically over these decades, and the tubes could carry only so much. Ripping them out and replacing them with bigger tubes was deemed too pricey. Moving mail by truck would be more efficient. So the post office shut down its pneumatic mail tubes on December 12, 1953. That was an investment decision, the kind any company would have made, and one that allowed the post office to keep growing. The Staples deal, by contrast, drowned in a bureaucratic swamp, tangled up in politics and labor relations. Absent fundamental changes to these kinds of structural obstacles, the odds are long that the USPS will become the innovator it once was. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Politico. On the health and science page, we have a short article titled, "How Humans Are Still Evolving." Human evolution is often thought of as a process that ended millennia ago when our ape-like ancestors morphed into Homo sapiens. But a new study has found that the process of natural selection continues, gradually weeding out life-shortening traits in modern humans, including genes that predispose people to heart disease, Alzheimer's, and heavy smoking. Geneticists examined the genomes of 210,000 people of European descent in search of mutations associated with greater or lesser longevity. Natural selection, a basic mechanism of Darwin's theory of evolution, is based on the principle that organisms best suited to their environments tend to survive longer, making it more likely that they'll pass their genes on to future generations. The researchers found that the APOE4 gene linked to Alzheimer's is becoming less common, particularly among women. A gene mutation associated with a strong addiction to cigarette smoking in men is also on the decline, ScienceDaily.com reports. It may be that men who don't carry these harmful mutations can have more children, or that men and women who live longer can help with their grandchildren, improving their chance of survival, says the study's co-author, Molly Saworsky. The analysis also reveals that genetic variants linked to heart disease, asthma, obesity, and high cholesterol all appear less frequently in people who live longer, an indication that humans may continue to adapt to a constantly changing environment. And we'll roll right over to the Talking Points page with an article titled, Clinton, Settling Scores with Sanders. Hillary, time to exit the stage, said Douglas Schoen in TheHill.com. Not a year after her humiliating election loss to Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton is back, hawking her campaign memoir, What Happened, and assigning blame for her defeat on Russian meddling, the media, former FBI Director James Comey, sexism, and Democratic primary rival Bernie Sanders. Deriding his far-left policies as unrealistic, Clinton says Sanders' attacks on her as a corrupt tool of Wall Street banks and rich donors did lasting damage, making it easier for Trump to paint her as Crooked Hillary. While perfunctorily admitting she made some big mistakes, Clinton clearly still does not realize why she lost. She was a weak, deeply unpopular candidate who simply did not stand for anything. Now her, quote, tour of petty, unquote, is reopening wounds and further dividing a broken Democratic Party, said Catherine Temp in NationalReview.com. The fact that she lacks the self-awareness to see that is so Hillary, it hurts. Clinton is right about Bernie Sanders, said Jill Filipovich in CNN.com. His attacks on her character fed the same narrative as Trump's, and the number of disaffected Sanders backers in key battleground states who didn't vote for Clinton was enough to swing the election. Sanders and his loyalists, meanwhile, continue to heap scorn on Clinton while joining Republicans in telling the only woman in American history to run for president on a major ticket to shut up and go away. And not incidentally, has any male politician ever been told to say she's sorry as often as Hillary Clinton? Clinton does have a real message in this book, said Bill Scheer in Politico.com. She's warning Democrats, don't give Bernie the keys to the party, or he'll drive it off a left-wing cliff. In recent months, Democrats are bending in his direction. Witness how Senator Kamala Harris of California and other potential presidential candidates are now lining up to endorse Sanders' favorite cause, single-payer health care. Clinton, however, portrays Sanders as a socialist ideologue given to unrealistic promises who can't make the trade-offs essential to governing. Granted, she's an imperfect messenger. A new NBC News Wall Street Journal poll puts her approval rating at an abysmal 30%, 6 points worse than Trump's. But perhaps Clinton's unpopularity liberates her to do what elected Democrats cannot, front-stab Bernie. After all, she has literally nothing to lose. 9/11 anniversary. Why terrorism persists. 16 years after the cataclysmic events of 9/11, it's time to take stock of where we stand, said Tom Nichols in TheHill.com. Have we faced down the threat from Islamist terrorism? Or have we surrendered to it, perhaps in ways we didn't even understand? Osama bin Laden knew in 2001 he could never defeat us by force. The al-Qaeda leader wanted to bait us into defeating ourselves, to make us abandon our values and lash out in ways that would make the rest of the world turn against us. Well, mission accomplished. More than a decade and a half later, Americans remain irrationally obsessed with terrorism, despite our success in limiting its toll. We've spent tens of billions of dollars building a new national security state, accepted massive infringements on our privacy and civil rights, and compromised many of the country's defining principles, all in the quest for an absolute security that isn't possible. The threat of Islamist terrorism may not be fully extinguished in our lifetime, said Robin Wright in NewYorker.com. In the past, terrorist groups such as FARC and the IRA ended up negotiating to achieve their political goals. Other terrorist groups were crushed by the state in which they operated or fell apart when their leader was killed. But the same won't happen to ISIS, Al-Qaeda, or the Taliban. Their ideologies are completely at odds with Western values, making negotiations next to impossible. And they're too scattered and resilient to be erased with battlefield victories. Unfortunately, technological advances are making terrorism easier, said David Garenstein-Ross in Fortune.com. ISIS reached millions of potential recruits on social media with slick and effective propaganda. Extremists can now groom jihadists online without ever meeting them. Perhaps the most dangerous development, said former FBI terrorism specialist Ali Soufan in the Atlantic.com, is the Islamophobia that's taken root in the U.S., including in the current White House. It would delight bin Laden and his acolytes who had hoped to turn Americans against Muslims. He'd also be happy with the deep divisions plaguing American society, which make us weaker and more vulnerable. Meanwhile, Islamist terrorism retains its toxic potency, and myriad extremist groups have sprung up in such failed nations as Syria, Yemen, Libya, and Afghanistan. This is likely to be a generational war. To win it, our ideas and values must be stronger than our enemies. And we'll finish out the show with a quote from Joy Reid. She is the an MSNBC host. This was quoted in nymag.com. Ms. Reid says, "Children don't hold you back from your adventure. They're just a part of it." Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. I'm Fred Woodward, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.